Radio City, once again, John Grayson and Rob Ross here with you, hanging out, doing our level best to go through some of the latest from the pop culture world. And so what's going on, Mr. Robert Ross?
Well, a whole bunch of things. I'm sure you've seen, read, heard, as I have, and tried to digest without becoming queasy. I mean, that's what pop culture is, really, at this moment. It's such a negative and nebulous thing, which is very sad when you get right down to it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, with Pop Dose, we try to put a positive, laughable, tongue-in-cheek, and to a degree, consciously corny spin on things that equal pop culture. And an example of that is, I was in the other night, and my wife was in this morning at our local Dunkin' Donuts, and she realized that XM Radio has something that they call the Yacht Rock Channel. And of course, Yacht Rock is a topic that's very, or a genre, I should say, is a topic that's very near and dear to the hearts of so many of the good folks at Pop Dose. And I will have to grant you that it dawned on me this morning as we were talking about some of the songs that she heard while she was waiting. It made me realize that, yet again, a very strong symbol of age is that songs that made you want to retch when you were a kid,
uh-huh,
just heard them, are songs that make you smile now, sing along, that you like, and you still know the words, even though you hated it back then. You sing along with it now in a sort of loving way.
Yeah, oh, no doubt. And it's, I mean, we were talking last week about going to see Mamma Mia and hearing all of the ABBA. Now, that doesn't really fit exactly into the genre, but still, it was that same sort of feeling where it's all of a sudden, boy, when my sister played this stuff, I wanted to shut my door and stick cotton in my ears. And now it's just kind of fun.
And when she brought up some of the songs, and when you and I last week were talking about things like Michael Johnson's Bluer Than Blue, which definitely fits in this genre, and then I started reeling off the ones that I could think of immediately. The one that comes to mind first and foremost is Steal Away by Robbie Dupree. That's to me, that is the ultimate yacht rock song, not Sailing by Christopher Cross. I would say followed up by that by I Keep Forgetting by Michael McDonald.
Right, right.
That's like real yacht rock, right to the T.
Well, here's the funny thing about that is that this also happens to be the week of the 36th anniversary of MTV. 36 years ago it took air. I think it was August 1st, 1981. And that song, Steal Away, was one of the first 200. We got a list of the first 200 songs they played. And everybody knows Video Killed the Radio Star. But yeah, in there, and in fact, I think it was in the top 20, was Steal Away. So, yeah, I mean, it had its place in history.
I don't suppose Checking Out the Checkout Girl by Wasmo Nariz made that top 200. that was a video that made the regular rounds on a show that was on in the New York market. I'm not sure about the rest of the country, called Rock World.
Uh-huh.
And it was a show that was on Friday nights. Now, I just don't remember if it was 11:30 or 12:30. Friday nights on Channel 5. And you would see things that you would never see anywhere else. And that's not an exaggeration. This was the only outlet for it. Sometimes they would actually do label shows. And the reason why I brought up Wasmo Nariz, because I was thinking of Rock World earlier and some of the specific label shows. That was on the IRS show.
Yep.
They had that video. They had the video for Garbage Man by the Cramps. Back in Flesh by Wall of Voodoo from the first album. They had a Stiff Records episode in which they showed the videos of A Pop Song by Reckless Eric,
mm-hmm,
Lucky Number by Lena Lovitch, Swords of a Thousand Men by Tenpole Tudor, Buena from Joe King Carrasco and the Crowns, and they showed all three videos from the first Dirty Looks record, Let Go, Lie to Me, and Love Crimes. So, yeah, I was just thinking that was the outlets that we had that we appreciated and tuned into, because it almost seemed like MTV was an afterthought.
Yeah.
MTV was more for the top 40 audience, because we of the punk rock new wave genre, while we lived and labored in musical obscurity, going to the specific record stores that we knew would carry the stuff that we wanted, it was a show like Rock World which was the place to see these performers that we hadn't seen. That was the first place that I ever saw The Jam, when I saw the video for Going Underground. So, you know, it was just, I don't know how I managed to digress from yacht rock and the problem pop culture, but MTV is such a strong symbol of pop culture. It's ironic and sad that it's still called MTV and being for music television when they don't even show any videos.
Right. Well, and as has been so many times pointed out, not only was it top 40 back in the early days, it was Lily White top 40. It was very white. In fact, they had almost no black artists at all until Michael Jackson and CBS forced them into it.
You know, the funny thing is that going along with what I was saying earlier about pop culture, right now, MTV is one of the arbiters of garbage pop culture.
Yeah.
Atrocities like Teen Mom and 16 Pregnant and Catfish. Really, it is shameful.
Yeah, and from its beginnings, I mean, there were some great things that went on there, and it was this perfect melding of not only some really good music, because let's face it, I mean, the early 80s were, if nothing else, they were very diverse, and you were going to find something in there that was good, you were going to find something in there that would appeal to you, but there were also these avant-garde filmmakers who had no other outlet that was going to get any kind of mass exposure at all until MTV came along. So not only did we get great music, we got a bunch of weird shit that we never would have seen. Styles of filmmaking that we never would have been exposed to as teenagers were coming at us through MTV.
And a lot of those early videos, going along with what you just said, were in fact, you know, small cinematic, you know, epics.
Yep.
The videos that Russell Mulcahy did for Duran Duran are the embodiment of that.
Right. Right. Well, and even before that, you had Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, who gave us some of the best videos ever on MTV, because Tom Petty's Don't Come Around Here No More, which was later on, was a fantastic thing, that the sort of Alice in Wonderland weirdness of it all. But the one that caught my eye first was You Got Lucky, which was this post-apocalyptic look back at now, and now being 1982 or 83 or whenever it was. And you had this hellscape that they were walking in out of, covered in dust, with these duster jackets and, you know, and cowboy hats and things like that. And they walk into an old abandoned pub and start kicking over video game consoles. It was, you know, it was just great. It felt cool.
As most of those videos did, because they all had a visual quality and texture to them.
Yep.
You could go 1 minute from seeing something like In a Big Country to
great video, by the way,
Space Age Love Song to, I'm trying to think of something that's really stripped down and basic, but still no less effective video wise. But okay, you know, you go to something like Hungry Like the Wolf or Save a Prayer, but then you see something like Long Hot Summer or Speak Like a Child by the Style Council, which were the antithesis of those kinds of pop acts, but still, you watch the videos and there's a certain enhancement,
right,
to the songs by seeing them, because the songs themselves, those two songs in particular, are indeed so cinematic lyrically that when you see them, it was one of those happy accidents, if you will, or happy meldings of the visual fit, the music and lyrics.
Yeah, they all did. I mean, even videos like George Thorogood and the Destroyers' Bad to the Bone was an homage back to the past. And I mean, that scene where Bo Diddley shows up and you see that shot of the cigar being tapped, you know, the ash being tapped onto the pool table. It was a story that went along with the song, and it both of them fit perfectly. And the funny thing about that is that there are so many songs now that when I hear them, the video plays in my head alongside them.
You know, interestingly enough, people have had over the years problems with that notion, which I don't agree with. I agree with you. You know, you hear a song, you visualize, you know, the video. People look at it as, well, now it's been co-opted instead, and it's become, you've been robbed of the possible interpretation you could put into your own mind and thoughts. That's nonsense. That's overanalyzing something that's not there.
Right.
But, you know, it's interesting. We talk about that first year to 2 years of MTV's birth and surging, and because it surged, and it surged fast, like nobody's business. And you know, you've got those videos from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers and George Thorogood and some of the ones that I named earlier. But then in 1982, most people don't realize that shoveled in there somewhere, probably late at night or on overnight, because there were no real playlists or shows per se, you also had the video of Wolves Lower from Chronic sound, which is about as stripped down as you're going to get.
Yeah.
Single camera, you know, performance video where you got to see REM at their best as they were at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's, I love that because that's, to me, those are always the best kinds of videos because they're so anti-production productions.
Right.
You know, just that, yeah, they're miming to it, but it captured their intensity and excitement on stage the way the young Stipe kind of throws himself around while he's performing it. And, you know, Pete Buck and Mike Mills were always visually striking. And you see, you know, Bill Berry back there just being as muscular as he could be on the drums. And it's funny because I think that video, people forget, it puts pay to Stipe's rhapsodizing over the years about how he never lip synced or mimed to a video until Losing My Religion. Nonsense, because Wolves Lower is a mime.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, he did. He did actually sing in the studio to the backing track of South Central Rain in the video for that, but he is lip syncing to Wolves Lower. So I'm sorry. You got that one wrong, son.
Yeah. Well, and not to mention the fact that there were so many people who it was like the Law and Order of its day in that the guest stars that showed up in a lot of these videos became famous later. Courtney Cox, famously from the Bruce Springsteen video. And you had very early on. Remember John Parr?
Yeah.
St. Elmo's Fire.
Yeah.
And before that, he had, or maybe it was after, I don't remember the chronology, but he had another song called Naughty Naughty.
Yeah.
And it was a, you know, straightforward rocker, but the girl in the car with him in that video is a very young Lisa Rinna.
Oh. Right. Well, I mean, then of course there's Tony Kattan, who went from being a centerfold to being Tom Hanks's squeeze in Bachelor Party to being the girl in the Whitesnake videos.
Right.
Of course, that's now 87, and we're 5 years down the road, or 6 years down the road from the birth of MTV, and MTV ruling the airwaves.
Right. And, of course, you had her wonderful cinematic triumph, Witchboard, was sandwiched in there somewhere, too. But, yeah, it was just good times. And, I mean, not to mention the fact that you get to see a lot of the artists that we've become familiar with over the years as kids. And I've often said that I don't think there is positionally a more beautiful woman at the time than Ingrid Bergman in Casablanca. You cannot look at her and not be immediately in love with her. In the same way, I don't think there's ever been a more adorable woman, you know, just a bigger cutie than Patti Smyth in Scandal's Goodbye to You video.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm probably the only one of all my friends who really dug her that just I was never into her. But you have to understand something. The great love of my life to this day appeared in 78, whenever it was that Parallel Lines came out, because once Deborah Harry took hold of my imagination and my soul, that was it. It was over. Every other woman paled in comparison. And any other woman who sang was definitely going to, you know, never reach the apex that Ms. Harry had, will have, has had, still has. I mean, to me, it was Debbie Harry or bust.
Right.
You know, so Patti Smyth was cute, sure. I mean, who else was around in those days that did videos? And I mean, Lena Lovitch was really cute too.
And later, you know, a couple of years later, you had the Bangles and the Go-Go's and all of that. So,
okay, you know what? Now you, because that's prime MTV. Were we all in love with the Go-Go's? Absolutely.
Yep.
I mean, I made sure that in those days, I only dated girls that dressed in that Go-Go style with the mini skirt and the headband. You know, I was always looking for a girl who kind of looked like Kathy Valentine because she was my Go-Go.
There you go. And of course,
to quote Gary Lewis in the Playboys, my Little Miss Go-Go. But then there were the Bangles.
I went
into the psychology behind Susanna Hoffs. But, man, the first one I really had a bad crush on was the original bass player, Annette Zelinskis.
Yep.
You see the video for The Real World, which I still think is their best song. Wow. But those girls, just goddesses. Absolute goddesses.
No doubt. No doubt about it. Well, we've got, you know, speaking of, here's my talent as a segue artist, because MTV doesn't play videos anymore, but you find a bunch of them elsewhere on popdose.com alongside a lot of the columns that are about music. And we're going to go into a couple of yours this week, because there's a video up for a song that features Keb Mo. Now, all you have to do to get me to watch a video or listen to a song is tell me that Keb Mo is part of it. I'm there. But it comes from a band that just released their self-titled debut album. The Dust Bowl Revival, great name, first of all. Let's start there. And when you have a band that has a bunch of players in it, it's great because you always have something to fill the empty spaces, but it can also be a tricky thing to manage because you've got so many people playing all at once to manage all of that. I think they did it really well here.
Well, I think the interesting thing about what you just said is the fact that we have already a preconceived idea of what a band should be. Three, four, five piece max.
Yep.
Anything after that is an ensemble or a collective, really. And then you're getting to the point of being a mini orchestra.
Right.
Having said that, though, you know, it's – I don't want to sound like I'm pigeonholing anything, but a band or group, if you will, a group like the Dust Bowl Revival – it fits more in that Americana-ish vein by virtue of the fact that a lot of these Americana-type groups are, in fact, ensembles. It's never just three, four, five piece.
Right.
Because they want to have a bigger sound, because the phrase Americana itself can be very limiting. Let's start with that. And the thing is, Dust Bowl Revival really isn't just Americana. They're a mixture of Americana, American, pure American, and I mean in terms of soul and funkiness. And it seems to me, in listening to the album, a lot of it has drawn its influences from New Orleans. That seems to be its —
I hear that too —
its pinpoint, which is interesting for a band from LA.
I can feel the weather change.
Nevertheless, their sound is that kind of, I don't like the phrase modern jazz ensemble, because first of all, modern jazz is a very specific genre itself.
Yeah.
Quick history lesson, folks. Anything between 1947 and 1968 that came out on Blue Note, Atlantic, Prestige, Savoy, Fantasy, that's the modern jazz era. Okay. But we're talking about modern in the here and now, to not be misinterpreted. And modern jazz ensembles do tend to be a collective, because you need to have all those different nuances and parts fleshed out. You need guitar, bass, drums, keyboards, you need vibes, you need horns. So the Dust Bowl Collective really has put themselves in a very fortuitous position by being that big and that broad.
Yep.
So they can get the feel across. At the same time, they put in some really nice bits of country and some 70s-styled funk, you know, but then they go into some quiet acoustic. It's a very well-rounded, very well-thought-out album.
Right.
You know, it's – you know, you also get to a point, you're on your sixth album, you've got to do something new and something hopefully fresh. Because at that point, you've obviously established yourself, you want to keep growing.
No doubt. And it, you know, it does that again with a very deft hand, because it never sounds too big for itself. And yet it's just, it's an awful lot of fun to listen to, which is the best thing that I can ever say about a piece of music, is that I have a good time when this music is playing behind me. So definitely want to check out the Dust Bowl Revival's new release. And of course, some video up online at popdose.com. And Richard X. Heyman is a guy that we have also talked about before, but I think it's been a while. I think it's been maybe a year or two since he's come up here on the program, but he's got new music out as well. What is it?
Well, first of all, would you believe it's already 4 years since almost the time that we've been doing this together on Overnight America?
And I seems right. With, yeah.
Yeah. A couple of reviews. Yeah. His last album was, was actually at the end of 2012, and you and I talked about it in 2013. But yet Richard X. Heyman, now see, I've known slash known about Richard since around 1980, 81, when I bought his first single, which was ironically called Vacation. And I remember where it was and when I got it. It was hanging on the wall. It was brand new at the time, came out, was hanging on the wall of Golden Disc Records on Bleecker Street. And the way that a lot of us, you know, certainly in my little group of friends, used to buy singles and albums back then, if we didn't know who they were per se, it was just by how interesting or cool the record sleeves were. And singles were $1.99 for, you know, import and independent singles. So, you know, I bought it. So I've been a fan ever since. And he's been around since the 60s, believe it or not, as the drummer for the Doughboys, which is a Jersey-based neo-psychedelic pop group who are, in fact, a going concern again in the last several years. But he's been putting out records on his own since 80, 81. This is his 12th solo album. It's called Incognito, and it is just, it's one of those wonderful reminders that it doesn't matter how long you've been around, how long you've been at it, when you hit it just right, everything else is negated because it's that good of an album.
Yeah, and I like that his delivery, too, has a lot of throwback in it. There's a lot of older style ways that he presents a song, and it in fact, at times can sound a little Dylan-esque. The difference is that where Dylan went on purpose into that very loose sounding, almost rambling, shambling kind of delivery in a song, this is very tight. It's very professional. It's very polished, but it doesn't sound overproduced either. So it really sounds great. And I think it's an interesting melding of hearing that kind of delivery with a definite newer style of presenting a song.
Well, that's the beauty of it. And also what you just said about him being a bit older, you know, I think it's a sense of him putting his voice where the sound of his vocal delivery has to fit the song. It has to fit the lyrics. It has to fit the meaning and the emotion and the delivery itself of the song. Thing about this album is that it's another one of those that, yes, it's a stylistic sameness because it is him, and if you know his music, he does have a style of his own. But, you know, a song like And Then is, it's, you know, Richard X. Heyman fronting the Feelies in REM. But then in Our Best Interest, which is kind of gospel-ish, my immediate thought was, surprise, surprise, Ballad of El Gudo. You know, but then also, one of his trademarks is the chime of the 12-string Rick. So for me, it's one of those albums that hits every one of the flavor notes I look for when trying to digest and absorb the delight of some kind of pop album that I'm expecting to be good, and it surpasses what I've already expected.
So again, Richard X. Heyman's Incognito, brand new out, and the review is up online at popdose.com. Definite got to get on this one. And elsewhere in music, there's a column that D.W. Dunphy wrote, and he had the review on the new album that's out from Cheap Trick. And they, I think, surprised a lot of people a couple of years ago when it wasn't even a renewal. I mean, it was just another Cheap Trick album. It had just been a little while, but I think people saw it as that sort of rebirth of the band. But then if you have a rebirth, there's always that opportunity for a sophomore jinx. And if anybody could get away with it, it's Cheap Trick. How's the new one?
Well, certainly DW gave it a very favorable review. Ironically, it's called We're All Right. Okay, you want to take that route, guys? Go ahead. Yeah. Obviously, you can. But here's my thing about it. And you brought up a really, really good point that everybody seemed to forget and overlook. You said it, you know, it was the album you're referring to, Bang Zoom Crash Hello, or Bang Crash Zoom Hello, whatever it was called.
Yeah.
It was seen as a revival of the band. People put it in that phrase because they were talking about it being the first album without Bunny Carlos. Well, not to nitpick, but factually speaking, people forget that after Dream Police, Tom Peterson had left the band and didn't come back until 1986, I believe, late 85, 86.
Yep.
So in those moments when they had massive hits during the 80s, certainly the one that I remember the most, because it's a song I really liked a lot, Tonight It's You, Tom Peterson wasn't part of the rhythm section. And Cheap Trick, in my mind, has always been and will always be Xander, Nielsen, Peterson, Carlos. The whole thing with Bunny Carlos, however, got ugly and got played out publicly, which is really a shame in so many ways. And the fact that the last album was the first to feature Dax Nielsen on drums, people signified that as the rebirth for whatever strange reason. I think more than anything, the embracing and appreciation for Cheap Trick is simply because their style, and we're talking about the original style, because Cheap Trick have never stopped going or stopped making albums, but people really do love those first five studio records that they did, the original five albums, Cheap Trick, In Color, Heaven Tonight, and of course, Dream Police. So I think that's a part of it. And then, of course, Live in Budokan is a staple of every, I think should be a staple of every household or every album collection. The new record, you know what? It's Cheap Trick. It sounds like Cheap Trick. Cheap Trick has a sound and style that's their own.
Yeah.
Robin Zander, albeit much older now, his voice isn't what it was, but he still has the voice. Rick Nielsen will always be one of the great guitarists out there. What more can you say? It's a Cheap Trick record. It's like a comfortable pair of shoes. It's not knocking it. It's just you have that comfortable pair of shoes you want to slip on. Well, you know what? In a time when you may have gotten tired of buying albums by people who you don't know but have been recommended and finding yourself let down consistently, you hear that Cheap Trick put out a new album, so you're going to buy it because it's something that you're comfortable with. How are you going to go wrong?
Things about this and what you said about Xander's voice is absolutely accurate. So Robin Zander, I think the trick is that he learned very quickly how to adjust to the fact that his voice is an older voice than it was. And we've seen guys, you talked about Paul McCartney a couple of weeks ago, and the fact that he's really struggling at this point, especially live, to keep up with a lot of the music that he created and wrote. I think it took, even in the recorded format, it took Robert Plant a long time to adjust to the fact that he just couldn't sing the way that he could when he was 22 anymore. And it was really, the album that he did with Alison Krauss, it took that to really get him to the point where he was comfortable in the way that his voice sounded at the time. So kudos to Robin Zander for being able to pick up on that. The other thing is, there's a couple of throwbacks here, because the album cover is that sort of sepia-toned collage, very reminiscent of the Beatles' second album. And of course, as you pointed out, We're All Right is a lyric from that song that they performed at the beginning of that 70s show, which, by the way, wasn't their song. Rob, remind me, who was it that originally wrote and sang that song again?
Oh, you mean the song that goes hanging out in the street?
Yeah, yeah.
Week, not a thing to do but talk to you. I think it was Chris Bell and Alex Chilton. It was actually Alex Chilton who wrote it, Chris Bell who sang it, and they were a band called Big Star.
That's right.
For fuck's sake. Ooh, wait a minute. I just broke my streak. I was going through this whole episode without actually using a cuss word, but now I've done it because it just irked me. But the thing is, We're All Right happens to come out, of course, from Surrender.
Right.
That's, you know, that's, I hate saying it, but if it's, I guess that's become the Cheap Trick theme song. I would have always said their calling card was, I want you to want me, but I guess not. I guess Surrender is the one that everybody knows.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I said, it's like a comfortable pair of shoes. And I think this is even them saying the same thing, having these throwback pictures and that style, having a lyric of theirs from 40 years ago being the album title.
Yeah.
I think that that's a, in a way, it's a good thing. It says that they can see themselves as they are now and who they were then.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. So one to pick up, but definitely want to check out D.W. Dunphy's review. We're going to get back to music in a little bit and talk about what Jack Ferick's been doing, because we've been covering the Too Old to Rock and Roll series, and it's now up to its seventh. But we'll get to that in a minute. Before we do, let's talk movies a little bit, because this summer has been a kind of an odd one. It's had its blockbusters, or its attempted blockbusters. It's also had, just recently, over the last month or so, some really miserable failures. And I think that was summed up by the release this week of another Stephen King adaptation. Dark Tower is out, and it's being roundly trashed. I have not seen it, but the thing is, this is not the first time we've seen this happen. Stephen King writes books that are 600, 700, 800 pages long, and trying to distill that down into an hour and 45 minutes is damn near impossible. So, yeah, a lot of the Stephen King adaptation movies have been terrible, but you have to look at what they're working with. I mean, some of the things that he wrote as short stories could easily be fleshed out into an entire movie. So that was kind of a miss, but it seems like this has been the summer of almost getting it right. You know, there's almost a good movie. There's almost something cool to say. And I don't know that I've seen anything so far this year that's really blown me away, except for finally renting the DVD and watching Get Out.
Oh, and you enjoyed it, I can
tell. Oh, yeah. That was a hell of a movie.
I told you. See, once again, you know, when Reverend Rob speaks, you listen.
Yep.
If Reverend Rob says an elephant's going to lay an egg, don't stand around. Go get the skillet. You know, it's interesting that you're talking about the Stephen King movie, because the one I was thinking about, and I have to be honest, the moment I saw the first commercial for it, I was immediately nauseated. It just raised my hackles to ire, thinking, are you seriously going to try this and try and trot this nonsense out as viable? That god-awful Charlize Theron movie, Atomic Blonde.
Oh, yeah, right.
Oh, dear. The commercials made me cringe. You know, the first thing they tried was the titillation factor to sell it, because she does a very hot lesbian scene in it. Ooh, we haven't seen that before. You know, and then you look at the commercial, and she's trying to be a combination of, you know, James Bond and, you know, Jason Statham.
Right.
You know, using her stiletto to drive it through the eye of the guy who's holding her at gunpoint. Guess what? Thankfully, that movie came in at number 4 on its opening weekend.
Yeah.
It was a flop. You know why? Because it looks stupid. Movies that play down to the audiences are not going to get you where you want to go anymore. I firmly believe that's the theory that's going right out the window as we speak. You know, there have been blockbusters. I mean, Wonder Woman, which, you know, you thought was okay. I haven't seen it, so obviously I haven't been running to the movie theater that frequently, but it rode the wave as far as it could go, and it did well at the box office, and people were not unkind about it. They've been more unkind to Gal Gadot than they have been to the movie itself, but I think it's because she's Israeli.
Right.
And that seems to be the topic that they love to bring up. Now, the purpose of that is kind of obvious. I'll play devil's advocate and just say, I have no idea why they have to go after her. She's an incredibly gorgeous woman. She shows that she can act in this movie. She's been in a couple of other things where she actually is kind of funny. She has a sense of humor and can do comedy, but their problem is that she's Israeli.
Right.
Which is a topic you and I can explore later on some other date or later in this show. But the thing is, that was a hit. That was a bona fide hit. These other movies that have been coming out are all there for about a minute and then gone. I mean, the Emoji movie.
No, yeah, right.
I mean, come on. This is why this has been the summer of, by and large, flops.
Yeah, and even the one that came out over the last couple of weeks that was supposed to do great things, Valerian and the Land of a Thousand Dances, or whatever the hell it is, we saw that one in the theater, and it was fine. It was fine. I mean, it took me about 30 minutes into the movie to really suspend disbelief and go along with it, because fucking CGI, oh, I hate it. I still hate it. It's gotten better. I still hate it. It's still cartoons to me.
Wait, hang on. Your opening sentence says it all. And it was ... fine.
Exactly.
... hesitation, fine. That is not going to sell tickets. And it's not, that kind of neutral endorsement is exactly what the movie studios don't want to hear. But that's what they're getting, because you're churning out mediocre products.
Yep. Yeah. And if you go back, I'm one of the people that I don't hate him for doing it, because the guy was making money. And fine, go make money. But I never got into Lucasfilms going back and redoing the old Star Wars movies and putting more banthas in them and shit like that, because, first of all, they didn't need it. We all loved those movies without them. And second of all, the special effects and the monsters and all of that was never what made those movies. What made those movies is they were fun. They were a great story and they were a blast to watch. Why is that so hard? Why can't we do that anymore without saying, ooh, we have to visually take this ADD audience and show them something shiny every couple of seconds? Fuck that. Tell a good story.
I'm sorry, is there some other version of Star Wars that I'm blissfully unaware of and willfully ignorant of?
just the DVD releases, yeah.
Star Wars movies, you know? There's only the trilogy, and then there's, you know, The Force Awakens.
Right.
I don't know anything else.
Yeah.
And if you say that there are others, I will indeed take my lightsaber and I will smite thee down.
Yeah.
Or Star Wars movies. Do we understand each other?
Oh, no doubt about it. But it's just, it's such a simple formula, you know?
It's almost like movie studios are following the blueprint of how the music industry screwed up.
Right.
You know, let's have an album. And let's all of a sudden take that album and put bonus tracks on it, two or three, you know, now that it's out on CD, and this is 5 or 6 years after the initial CD run, put some bonus tracks on it, then let's delete that, and let's do a two-disc version remixed in 5.1 with all the demos in their infancy stages and a completely remixed enough.
Yeah.
Enough. The reason why an album or a movie was a success at the outset is because it struck, no pun intended, a chord with people at the right moment. And you can't reheat a souffle. Why is it so difficult?
Yeah.
For record labels and for movie studios to understand that? Don't answer that. That's not even a rhetorical question. It's kind of an obvious.
Indeed. I don't get it. But again, it's just that chase for more cash, and they feel like that's what's going to get them there. Now, on that subject, I'm going to flip the TV for just a second, because I don't know if you have seen this yet. We didn't discuss this before. I haven't said a word about it, but there's a show on True TV, and I started to see the promos for it because they were promoting.
Is it Andrea Savage?
I'm sorry.
I adore her. Listen, she's had me from the moment that she first appeared on Funny or Die.
That show is incredible. I've been waiting so long for somebody to write something like that is essentially like if you took stand-ups and raunchy ones at that, people who were really good at it and who at the drop of a hat could come up with the best zinger in the entire world, or the most twisted fucking weird thing to say, and have it be on point and hilarious. What would it look like if those people just walked through a normal suburban life? And it's brilliant. Tom Everett Scott is brilliant in that show. She's brilliant in that show. It's just great.
Are we speaking of Guy Patterson, a.k.a. Shades?
That's right.
I wonder whatever happened to the drummer from the Oneaters.
Yeah, but if you haven't seen that one, David, take my advice. It is so brilliant.
When you said True TV, I knew exactly what you were talking about. But, you know, listen, all you have to do is just watch her brief performance, which is still hysterical because she's so good at the deadpan face.
Yes.
See, that's the great thing. I mean, she's a beautiful woman, but she does great comedic faces when she's doing her shtick. And her as the therapist for Brennan Huff in Step Brothers is absolutely magnificent because she's just so deadpan.
Yeah. And it's finally a show. It shares a lot of DNA with Louie in that it's that show that's not afraid to make a joke where you kind of cringe at it. And then you hate yourself for laughing at it because it's still funnier than hell, but it's so completely inappropriate. You know, it's great. It's a very unafraid way to go about making a TV show. And let's face it, if you're going to make something good, you have to be fearless.
What you just said about hating yourself for laughing at it because it's an inappropriate thing. That's what good true comedy is.
Yep.
It's laughing at the inappropriate, at the horrific. How many comics were chomping at the bit but quaking in their boots to make 9/11 jokes?
Right.
Because let me tell you something. Not long after it happened and I shook off my own shock, my first thought was, okay, enough with all the hand-wringing, because I'm sure there are a lot of people out there, a lot of wives that are glad that their husbands didn't make it off the 87th floor because they were philandering douchebags. You know, come on. Who are we kidding now?
Yeah. Well, and I was in high school in 1986 when the shuttle blew up, and that took about 10 minutes for the first jokes to start showing up. So, yeah, it's the way that we deal with it. It's the way that we distill life that makes it – that takes some of the shock and horror away from it. So, yeah.
I'm the first one to make Jewish jokes.
Right.
And you have to do it with a sense of, you know – tongue in cheek, and I can make jokes about everybody. Why? Because the human race as a general thing sucks.
Right.
You know, it's not about, and that's why we're in the pickle that we're in now. Because right at this particular moment in history, everybody is so amped up on being divided and segregated and separated and defined and classified, and you know, you have to have a label. Fuck all of you.
Well, on that, you know, if you're going to talk about that and going in that direction with the humor, you know why Hitler didn't drink?
Why?
Made him too mean.
How did they take the census in Israel?
How?
Roll a nickel down the street.
Oh, too much. John Grace and Rob Ross with you, hanging out. See, this is what happens when we get together, especially when I fell asleep in the middle of the day and I'm slap happy. So,
he is ginger ale because I don't drink alcohol.
Attaboy. Well, we've got a little bit more music to talk about. And as we mentioned, the Too Old to Rock and Roll column that Jack Furyk has been gracing us with for now 7 episodes of his return to making music, his return to live performance, his return to a band has been a joy to read and a joy to follow and a joy to listen to the music as well. We're up to episode 7. Where is he now?
Going to do a live gig. And that is read the whole thing, listen to it, the whole, just go. If you haven't been following the story, start with episode 1. But the beauty of this, I'm not going to say more than this. The beauty of it is it's actually gotten to a climax point of the story.
Yep.
Preparing for a live show after X amount of years on the sidelines, which is a fantastic thing. I am both overjoyed for him, very proud for him, and wonderfully, happily envious.
Yeah. It's.
But the thing is, I'm inspired by it.
Right. And it's not to be missed. And speaking of being inspired, so you really are. I mean, you're writing.
I am writing. On a path to do something, but until I actually get to that moment, and I will say declaratively, that moment when, quote, something happens, I won't talk about it that much because
good.
Over the years you and I have known each other, and going back slightly further than that, because it's been about a 5-year span overall, you know, I've talked about working on the album, which already is notoriously known as The Next Sometime Soon. And the only thing that I'd ever done was the demo. I mean, everything's done for it. The artwork, the layout, the credits, everything. Everything except the songs aren't recorded.
Right.
And, you know, I started that in 2010 when I actually recorded a slew of demos, but they were all the first basics. You know, I wrote the song and immediately recorded guitar and vocal demos for a good portion of them. And then I went back to being my usual lazy self.
Mm-hmm.
And like I've used as the excuse over and over again, look, if it could take Richard Barone the time between Clouds Over Eden in 1993 and Glow in 2010, then I can take my time with the next sometime soon.
Yeah. Well, and there's one more music column we're going to take a look at, because the other one that gives us no end of joy is Soul Serenade, Ken Shane's column. And he's done this a couple of times before, where a lot of the first Soul Serenade columns were all about taking one song and taking it apart and working it into its component parts and figuring out what it was that made it great. And a lot of times bringing back some soul classics that we wouldn't have thought of to put in a playlist, and has done so brilliantly. But he's done this a few times in the past, this A-B comparison of this soul artist did this song, and so did this one. Check them both out, and you tell me which one you like better. He did that again this week. What's the song?
I Can't Get Next to You. Which version do you like now? This is hard. This isn't not as easy as when you and I both kind of took apart, you know, which one do you give the nod to?
Right.
Respect by Aretha Franklin, which is the worldwide known hit version, the legendary version, or the original gritty in-your-face version by its writer, Otis Redding.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this one's harder because it's by two very different – one is by a group and one is by a solo artist.
Right.
One is the what I consider the original version by The Temptations. And then there's a version by Al Green. You're looking at two completely different ends of the spectrum in that respect. Which one did you find yourself more drawn to? I'll ask you. I'm going to throw it back at you.
Well, it's funny because, like you said, they attack the song in very different ways because they have to. Now, in Al Green's version, there are backup singers, but it's not the same kind of different voice on every line of the song, an almost call and response kind of deal, as it was with The Temptations. The Temptations version is a little more up-tempo, and I like that. And it's not even because it was the original one, because I was, by the time I was listening to music, both of them had been out for a while. But because of that, I really do. I like The Temptations version of that song because I just like that style. I can turn the gray sky blue. I can make it rain whenever I want it to. Too, having everybody in the group throw in a line of a song. I mean, Why Can't We Be Friends is that way. I love that. And because of that, I've got to give the nod to The Temptations.
You know, it's just the fact that I've also, you know, I basically grew up with this song, you know, as amongst many of the singles that were in my parents' collection. And it's not the original versus later version. It's the one that still speaks to you the most. It still tugs at you emotionally because, of course, you're catapulted back to a time. But like you said, the whole call and response group feel, there's something a bit more. It's also a lot meatier in the sense that Al Green made it sultry.
Yeah.
This is not a sultry kind of hey, baby kind of song. This is a hey, woman, you know.
Right.
Kind of thing. This one's a lot more audacious. You know, the Temptations version is more audacious. So I will give that the nod.
Yeah.
And that's an odd thing for me simply because we're talking Detroit versus Memphis here, and I'm giving the nod to Detroit.
Yeah, also true. But I think that both of us would probably say that this one is a hair's breadth kind of affair. It's not that the Temptations version was 10 times better. It's a little better.
It's Al Green's is different.
Yep.
That's how it is. It's not better It's different.
Right. Yeah. But both of them, well worth a listen. And give them a listen for yourself. That's what the comments section is for, so you can fight it out with everybody else who's wrong. So do that thing.
Is wrong. That's the whole thing.
Right, right. But, you know, we all feel that way, though. It's that, oh, yeah, well, obviously you disagree with me, so there's something deeply, deeply sociologically wrong with you.
I was saying to Liz just last night, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, most people don't seem to understand the fact that everyone in the human race is pretty much wrong about everything, and the only one who ever is seemingly right on a regular basis is me.
Right.
I don't mean other people saying, I'm the one who's right. No, no, no. Everybody else is wrong, and I'm always right. And I think if people would just get that through their thick skulls, they would realize that I'm the omnipotent one. I am the all-knowing. And if you cross me, I will have you filleted.
Exactly. Yeah, it seems to work that way for everybody. But yes, for some reason, I mean, we could put an end to war and all of the strife in the world overnight if everybody would just realize that. So,
well, hang on a second about the war factor. We're going to go in there and we're going to hurt the enemy. Bastard in the pants.
Yes. And when you stick your hand into a bunch of goo that a minute before was your best friend's face, then you'll know what I'm talking about.
You know, there are some days that Patton just had to slap somebody.
Yeah, absolutely true. And so did George C. Scott, I'm convinced.
Yes, Colleen Dewhurst and Campbell Scott.
Oh, wow. That's late night right there. And as we move along, we've got a couple more things to talk about. I want to get into a little bit of sports talk because as we get, again, closer and closer to the NFL season kicking off, life is getting better and better. However, we did do a preview of what was going on as the trade deadline approached when we were putting together last week's show.
Oh, God. That was talk about much ado about nothing.
No kidding.
Like I've never seen in baseball, John, the ballyhoo that surrounded my beloved Mets was such an embarrassment leading up to the trade deadline.
Yep.
And you know who they traded on trade deadline day? Nobody.
Nobody. Same as the Cardinals. They did the same thing. There was nothing but hype and nothing but worry that Pham was going to go away or that that Lynn was going to go away. No, they're all still here. Everything's the same.
The whole thing, trade deadline day, was, you know, Lucas Duda went the week before, and I could care less because I hated the guy. On the deadline morning itself, they traded Addison Reed, who is a so-so, not closer. He is definitely a seventh or eighth inning setup guy who by default became the closer this year and didn't do a good job of it whatsoever.
Right.
You know, and he's a free agent at the end of this year. So what? They picked up A.J. Ramos from the Marlins, who's a better pitcher, and they'll have him under control for a full season going into next year. He is now the de facto closer. Beyond that, nothing. Who cares? Did anybody make any blockbuster deals? I don't think the Yankees trade for Sonny Gray of the A's was anything to write home about. Nah. Because he lost his first game on Friday night to the Indians. And all the ballyhoo about the Dodgers picking up Yu Darvish because he beat the Mets Friday night in his first game as a Dodger. So what? Everybody's beaten the Mets this year. That's because the Mets bullpen has let them down enormously.
Right.
So, you know, it's, again, baseball is hurting itself by all the hype that they put around themselves with all the, what they think are enticements, you know, the big run-up to the trade deadline. Guess what? Nobody cares.
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
Well, and the big move in football this week was the fact that Jay Cutler was signed to a one-year deal by the Miami Dolphins. And as a Bills fan, I fully support this move.
Well, let me put it to you this way. As long as Colin Kaepernick doesn't have a job, things are fine in the NFL.
Right. But let's dissect that for just a second, because I want to avoid spreading bullshit. I try to do that wherever possible. And I think in this case, there's been plenty of it because, I mean, let's face it, it's August. The NFL Network needs something to talk about. And the speculation is, oh, you know, Kaepernick will never get picked up by anybody because of the kneeling during the national anthem thing. No, Kaepernick's never going to get picked up by anybody because he's not that fucking good.
Two words, damaged goods.
Right.
People have collective amnesia. He's got a bad elbow for a start.
Right.
And I believe it's his throwing elbow.
Yep.
Okay, do I need to elaborate then?
No, and even the promise that he showed, and I remember the first time I ever saw him play in preseason, and I saw him huck the ball 60 yards down the field, and on the next play, I saw him hit a screen pass perfectly and lay the ball feather soft into the hands of a running back. And I thought, you know, he's got it. He's got all the tools. He can throw the long ball, and he's got some touch. And then after that, it just, he had one good season and the rest of it just never materialized. He can't put it together. There's the one thing that he doesn't have is a head for the game.
The other thing is very simply, and you brought up the best point of the non-spreading of bullshit. People are going to try and use the kneeling thing as the non-selling point. Look, the NFL, as you and I talked about just last week and in prior weeks, is the one place where basically any felon can have a job.
Right.
Strike that. A convicted felon can have a job. And when someone as heinous as Michael Vick is allowed to play football again, what did Colin Kaepernick do? Nothing besides be an asshole in public.
Right.
It's the fact that he can't play the game. He's actually physically damaged goods.
Right. Yeah.
That's no one wants to take a chance on him. He can't play. What is so hard to get instead of trying to turn it into something that it's not? Michael Vick could play. It's just that he's the scum of the earth, so they let him play again.
Right. Yeah. Well, if it had been Tom Brady instead of Colin Kaepernick, nobody would have batted an eye. Nobody would have cared. Do you think he would have gotten cut from the Patriots for kneeling during the national anthem? Of course not. The guy wins Super Bowls.
Yeah, but Tom Brady needs to be impeached.
So. Well, and the one good thing this week is that they unveiled the wax figure of Tom Brady at some museum in Boston, and it turned into a big controversy because everybody looked at the thing and said, "That's not Tom Brady, that's Stifler." And I don't know if you've seen it. It looks exactly like Stifler. It's brilliant.
Somewhere Sean William Scott is smiling.
Exactly. Now, I just can't. Before we get to the In Our Head segment, we do have a couple of other things to go over. And of course, this week has been one of the most dismal yet for Donald Trump. And I don't know. It seems like every week we say that and every week we hear it. Oh, it's been another horrible week and he had his worst day ever as president. He doesn't care. He doesn't care, and it doesn't seem to be moving the needle. I don't know what it's going to take, but so far, okay, so he's had 6 months worth of lousy weeks in a row. He's still president.
Let me ask you something, though. The last time we spoke was last Sunday, and was the mooch still in his job, or was he fired already?
I think he had just been fired, because he went out on a Friday, so I think he had just been cut.
Okay, because I swear to you, it's every day. When it comes to the political circus, it blurs from one to the other. So I can't tell if it was before our last conversation or was it early this week. I mean, my God, every day is just another clusterfuck.
Yep.
And it doesn't seem to be getting any better. Now the witch hunt has moved itself, funnily enough, over to Eretz Israel. And now Bibi is under investigation again. Come on, people. He's already been convicted. You think anybody's going to get him out of office? Be realistic. And you know what? I hate this. I don't care if I offend anybody. I like BB. You know why? Because he has zero fucks to give.
Yep.
If you screw with the country, and if you're going to try yet again to make Israel give up its borders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you're barking up the wrong tree with that man. Yeah, he can line his pockets. So what? What politician hasn't or doesn't? You know, let's make that very, very clear. When it comes to that country, he has done a kick-ass job of keeping it as safe as possible under extraordinary circumstances.
Right. And moving it back home, I mean, Donald Trump, here's where I am with this thing now. Here is my state of zen with the fact that this moron is president of the United States. He hasn't done anything. It's been 6 months. He hasn't done a single thing to move any piece of his agenda forward, except for those ridiculous executive orders and a lot of the tweets nobody's doing anything about anyway. So as long as Congress continues to step on its own dick, and as long as Donald Trump continues not to have any interest whatsoever in doing the job, we're okay, except... And this is something that we haven't seen yet. I mean, it's now August. You remember that we were a month ahead of where we are now in George W. Bush's administration when September 11th happened. So that's the problem, is that there will come a time, probably in the not too distant future, where something horrible is going to happen. It's hurricane season. There's still terrorism out there. North Korea is enjoying fucking around an awful lot right now. And so something will happen that he's going to have to deal with, manage, and make decisions about. As long as everything's cool and all he does is say stupid shit and put tweets out at 5 o'clock in the morning, fine. We can make it through 4 years of that. But that crisis, whatever it is, whatever it happens, that's going to be the time when we're all going to look at ourselves and go, what the fuck did we do?
You know, I think actually that's already come and gone. Because the reality is on election night itself, that was the question.
True.
You know, I mean, it was, you know, and as much of a humorous spin as we can put on it, that was when it really wasn't funny. At this point now, it's a case of, like you just said, as long as he's doing nothing, and really... It's all down to Congress spinning its wheels. That's all they do. So everything really, it's not even so much Trump, it's more Congress being so ineffectual.
Right.
Everything is their fault because Trump himself has been as anti-Congress as the Democratic side, when you think about
yeah.
it. Because he's told them, get shit done, and they haven't done anything. You know, his executive orders are as meaningless as the most disposable pop song on the planet.
Yep.
You know, there's nobody cares because they're not there. There's no law behind it. You and I can write executive orders. If they're not enacted into law by a governing body, it's just empty rhetoric. And that's what, and Trump's not even good at rhetoric. He just says random shit. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if you hear him muttering, I kills them all one by one.
It puts the lotion on its skin, I think, is the last one.
Stupid the guy is. I mean, let us not forget, Donald Trump is a complete and utter moron.
Right.
No, he's really a genuinely ignorant human being. He's not educated by any stretch of the imagination. He speaks like an imbecile. You know, it's... To a degree, you almost have to take him out of the factor. What you have to look at and worry about is how Congress will act.
Right.
God forbid there's a crisis.
Exactly. Right. And now, you know, you look at the big revelation from this week that they released some of the transcripts, some of them leaked, I guess, from that series of phone calls that he was making on his first couple of days in office. And the one that he made to Peña Nieto in Mexico was particularly hilarious to me because effectively you have a guy who's learning on the job in real time that he doesn't have any real power, that other countries actually exist and that those countries have legislatures of their own and they mean something. When he was trying to make this paying for the border wall thing, Peña Nieto's problem, I picture him holding the phone away from his face and staring at it like it's a snake, going, what am I looking at here? What is happening in this world? Because, yeah. You know,
before he's got it on speakerphone. they're all like sitting there holding their mouths because they're trying not to burst into peals of laughter.
Exactly.
That's the way I envision it because he comes off as such an ass. But the thing is, you've noticed that other countries, and this is where it goes onto the negative flip side, other countries have learned how to bait him just as quickly.
Yep.
You know? And that's not good because this is now continuing with the worldwide view that America is weak.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And this started during the sacred Obama administration. You know, this didn't start with Trump. And collective amnesia, the kind that seems to befall everyone on the left, that started under, quote, your president.
Right.
Obama.
Right.
Theories and visions is what pissed off so much of the world.
Right. And at the beginning of his administration, you remember it was the right that got all pissed off at him for going off on what they dubbed the apology tour. Well, you know what? We wouldn't have to go around the world and apologize if you didn't spend 8 years pissing everybody off. So I don't know. It's a cycle that's going to continue. I'm really interested to see what's going to happen in the midterm elections, probably more than most people are. And it's not even just a matter of regaining power in the Senate or regaining power in the House for the Democrats and having some kind of real check on Donald Trump. It's more about just seeing what the reaction to this is going to be. Of 2 years of absolute buffoonery and poll numbers that are down for Donald Trump to 33%, does it matter? Does it rub off on anybody else? And at this point, I'm not convinced it will.
I don't think it will either. You know what's going to happen? Nothing. Those people will be reelected handily.
Yeah.
In fact, I bet you that some of these people are going to – I bet you the Republicans are going to gain more seats. You know why?
I wouldn't be shocked.
Because there are a lot. First of all, why did Donald Trump get as many numbers as he did, even though, you know, quote unquote, Hillary Clinton won the popular election? Because when it counted the most, there were more voters for him than people were willing to admit. And I think with the way that the left has conducted themselves and the way that they've shown themselves to be completely self-absorbed, fighting, completely fractured, there's no solid Democratic Party. It's the Democratic Party and this liberal, you know, communist party that Bernie Sanders is leading, you're going to see more Republican seats. I make a prediction right now. I bet you the Vermont seat currently held by old drool buckets will actually go to the Republicans.
Yeah. Well, we will we'll hold your feet to the fire on that one when it comes to November of next year. But yeah, I don't disagree at all, because the one thing that the Democrats have shown in all of this is a complete lack of being able to recover the fumble. And I don't know how they can just kind of look at the ball rolling around on the field and go, there's a ball in the field. Wonder what we ought to do with that. Just leave it there. But hey, what the hell? I'm not in charge. Now, with that said, we've got our In Our Head segment, which we end up with each and every week here on the broadcast. And thank you again for listening into our take on matters. But when it comes to this, this is just fun, because I was in traffic and I had to get from one end of town to the other to pick my wife up to go out on Friday night. And so I just put the phone on shuffle like I always do and skipped the songs I didn't want to hear and was looking for something that was just, you know, traffic music, something that had a nice driving beat to it, something that I could really kind of get into and would take my mind off of the fact that I was sitting in traffic. And then something came on that was completely not that. And it reminded me how much I love a really talented group of people putting together an instrumental. I love vocals. I love songwriting. I love somebody who's got a great turn of phrase. But when you hit a great instrumental, there's something that just trips off in your brain. And the fact that the sun was shining and I had the sunroof open and the windows open and I was pumping the meters out of my car at full blast. Neville and those guys, holy shit. I mean, and I was just in my element. Nothing else mattered. At that moment, all I was doing was just floating along with the beat of that song. And for a good 5 minutes, I was one happy dude. So let's get into instrumentals just a little bit. Tell me what it is when you think of it being done right, what is it that pops into your head?
The first thing is how catchy it is.
Yeah.
But even if you're sitting and waiting for lyrics to come along, the melody is there. It's, you know, almost from, you can always tell a good song or a song that really means something in your mind, your heart, your being when you hear it, almost from the first few bars, that it's just there and it's with you. And when, you know, it's an instrumental, you almost at the end, you sit there going, okay, it doesn't need words. It doesn't need to be interrupted or disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
Got a fully realized piece right there in front of you. And there are several that come to my mind because they're still a part of me. The first one that I can think of, believe it or not, is Walk Don't Run by The Ventures.
Oh, I believe it fully. That's a great song.
I used to play it to death as a child. My parents had the original 45 on Dalton, which, in fact, I still have that 45. And, you know, it's one of those instrumentals. It's a song for all time. And it was a song that my father in particular loved. And when I got my first guitar, he said, I will be impressed. You know, he said it jokingly, I'll be impressed the day you can play Walk, Don't Run. And one day, he came home from work and I said, hey, come here. I'm going to set up a bet with you. And he comes into my room and goes, what is it? And I just picked up the guitar and I just started wailing right into it, you know. He was both impressed and really proud that I was able to do it.
Great.
Because I'm a self-taught guitar player.
Yeah.
So that's the one that pinpoints the most at me. Another one is Cast Your Fate to the Wind by the Vince Guaraldi Trio. And that's because of the Vince Guaraldi Orchestra, and that is simply because of the association with Charlie Brown.
Yep.
It was that track that was the precursor to what became the Charlie Brown theme, and subsequently all the music that was in the early Charlie Brown specials. And interestingly enough, therein lies a story, because last night my wife came and watched the end of the Peanuts movie with me, and I grew up a Peanuts fanatic. I mean, when I was a small child, my room was festooned in Peanuts stuff. And so that music is part of my fiber from the time that I could walk. And she was saying how nice it was to see a movie with a happy, non-beating you over the head with a message, sweet film that you could actually sit your children down to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to learn a lesson just in a natural, organic way. It's a simple story. And it's sweet, and it's emotionally moving and touching. And the music fits that movie, that mood. And so many of the songs that were used over the years are all in that movie. So I was explaining to her how important that the soundtrack is to certainly the Peanuts.
Right. Well, and I'm going to hit you with four or five just off the top of my head. And you know, among my favorites when it comes to the instrumental, because I had a conversation a long time ago with Joe Satriani about wondering what was going to happen when Surfing with the Alien was released, what the reception was going to be, how weird it was in that era to have an instrumental rock album, especially a guitar-centered instrumental rock album come out. And it wasn't a given, even though the music was outstanding, that thing was going to work. And so he said, you know, when it sold and he won Grammys and all of that, he was as amazed as anybody was that something that didn't have any words to it, that people couldn't sing along with, really worked. So it does take some balls to say, I wrote this great riff, I'm going to turn it into a song, and nobody's going to sing a word on it. So when I think of that mentality, the ones that come to mind, Take Five, Green Onions. What else is in there? Hugh Masekela's Grazing in the Grass. But, you know, some of the Jimmy Page guitar work stuff that he did on Led Zeppelin 3 and Led Zeppelin 2. Really, really pretty stuff. And again, a lot of 12-string acoustic guitars behind all of that. So that's going to have something for me. But, I mean, those songs that hit a groove like Take Five does, there's nothing better than that. And where it doesn't seem like there's anything missing by the fact that there's no words in that song.
Well, now here you've thrown it right to me, and now you know that I'm chomping at the bit like a lion waiting for that piece of me, because what is my number two? Let's see how well you know me after all these years. What is my number two favorite song in the history of mankind after Paperback Writer? What's my number two song? And it's an instrumental.
Wow, I don't know.
Time Is Tight, Booker T and the MGs.
Absolutely.
Time another one that I get goosebumps when I hear it to this day. I still have the 45 on Philips, light blue label, Philips Records, 1968. Sometimes it makes me want to cry. It's such an incredibly beautiful and moving piece. Love is Blue by Paul Mauriac.
Yeah.
That one. That is just one that will, that's one where your heart just skips beats because it is just so incredibly beautiful. And yep. I do mean beautiful. Another one that always gave me a charge, Telstar.
Yes.
It's just such a great, strange, and it's such a random kind of musical moment, you know, that I just really, you know, that's another one that I love. Beck's Bolero.
Yes.
Talk about a moment, but also look at who played on it. It is a very stripped down band, but it's obviously Jeff Beck, John Paul Jones, Jimmy Page, and quote unquote, you know who on drums. And the reason why they said you know who,
right,
is because under contract to Decca Polydor Records, you couldn't say Keith Moon.
Keith Moon. Yeah. So this is part of the reason, again, why we have the comment section at the bottom of the page, because I know that this has kicked off probably 10 or 12 different titles in your head as well. So if you want to leave some of your favorites in the instrumental realm down on the bottom of the page, we'd be glad to have you do that. And of course, make a playlist out of them all later. And Rob Ross, I think that's just going to about wrap it up for you and me this week. Have yourself a brilliant week once again. And now we've actually got our first NFL game in the can. And we're looking for a full slate of preseason games coming up this weekend. But, you know, it's preseason. Who cares?
Preseason means nothing. That's like watching preseason baseball and preseason hockey. Until those games count, until they go into the standings, it means zilch. You know what? I saw the Mets have a perfect preseason, and that was the year that they were the worst team money could buy. So do I need to elaborate on that? That's not an exaggeration. It was 1992. They had a perfect spring training. Worst team they ever had.
And on the other side of that, my Bills, when they were going to the Super Bowl every year, of course they were losing, but they still got there. And I think the best they went in preseason that entire stretch was 1-3.
There you go. So, look, we got seasons to look forward to. And we've got something in the can already. That I don't know if you've seen this or seen the preview, but this should be really good fodder for a tear-it-to-pieces section next week. There is a remake that I only just found out about of Death Wish.
Oh no.
are you sitting for this?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You better stand up so you can sit down again. Starring Bruce Willis.
Oh.
It's Paul Kersey.
No. I already hate this. I already hate this idea.
The most offensive thing is it's directed by Eli Roth, a man who should know better.
All right. Well, yes, that will give us plenty to rip apart next week. Rob Ross, have yourself a great one.
You too, brother. I'll see you later.
Kick around elsewhere on popdose.com. Look it up. There's so much great material out there, so you can get yourself imbued in all of it, not just the music, but, of course, the movies and the books and everything else. So do that thing and be here with us for Radio City next week.